I will refine for you, Jeff, if I don't do it tonight, by next week, I'll refine for you the exact issue of IEEE Antennas and Propagation Journal. The journal, the monthly journal from Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE. This was an article in the back of the issue by one of their contributing editors, and describing the situation that was a judgment in Lyon, France, but that's not the town where it took place. And the judgment, this all happened, I believe, in the year 2010, and it's being reported in the IEEE Journal, Antennas and Propagation, of 2011. Spring of this year is when that was. I'll refine that issue, tell you the exact page. Now, the problem is, do you have IEEE access by way of what's called Explore? If not, I've got to find some other way of getting a copy of that to you. One way or another, I can get you a copy of that article, Jeff. So I may have the town mixed up, but we'll eventually get that one to you. Mr. Zebra Hotel India, I think it was. Give me your full call and name and your question on this subject. KQLIW.
This is Richard Sizzlehead again.
Okay, I could tell that Rich was saying something. And I can tell he's angry with me. Other than that, I didn't get the message. Want to go a little bit slower and say it more clearly, Rich? Go ahead.
Richard Sizzlehead was hit again by lightning.
Okay, Rich is telling us something was hit by lightning. A little bit slower. What got hit by lightning when, Rich? Go ahead.
Me. I understand.
Okay. You got hit by lightning. Give us a few more words on that, there. Any equipment damage? Did it happen today? Over to you, sir.
No, about an hour and a half ago, 2 hours ago, radio was not connected, but there was a boom, and the lights, no, the lights didn't blink, no, just the instant bang.
Out of curiosity, what town do you live in, Rich?
This is Rich on Sizzle Lane.
I heard you say, this is Rich, blank, blank, blank. You've got to say it a little bit slower, a little bit more clearly. Rich, what town are you in, please?
Okay, it's KC2LTY, Richie in Mineola, on Searing Avenue, which you call Sizzle Lane.
Okay. Sorry to hear that. Sizzle Lane, is that what I called it already? Okay, glad you weren't suffering any damage, and I guess... your particular location where lightning seems to be very popular, it's very smart that you disconnect your antennas when you know a lightning storm is coming. Although modern day equipment can tolerate an awful lot. I've had direct strike on my tower on one occasion with all the antennas connected, and I suffered no radio damage. The computers in the house and the television set suffered quite a bit of damage, because I can tell a great big spike occurred on the 110 volt line when the tower was struck, but the radio equipment kept right on playing. Okay, when it comes to 800 megacycles, an awful lot of fire equipment runs on 46 megacycles. Quite a bit of fire equipment runs on 155 megacycles, approximately. And many of those pieces of fire equipment are being converted over to 800 megacycles. Let me drop. As you guys probably know, at the same time that we established digital television techniques in the United States, a whole lot of previously used broadcast frequencies became freed up for other services like first responders. So the first responders are getting a certain number of brand new frequencies. And most of those new frequencies, I thought, are in the 700 and 800 megacycle frequency region. And the way somebody worded it earlier, they made it sound like the 800 megacycle equipment is being abandoned for higher frequencies. I'm very skeptical of that. Because as you go to higher and higher frequencies, let's assume that there was a band at 2 gigahertz, and I'm going to operate a handy-talkie at 2 gigahertz, you definitely are going to get a smaller number of miles of range into a fire radio handy-talkie at 2 gigahertz than you are at 800 megs. And you're going to get less range at 800 megs than you are at 150 megs. There's a whole lot of physics that'll back that up based on the effective capture area of the antennas, the amount of foliage attenuation of trees, particularly when there's water on the trees, and so on. So you may think that somebody is proposing to put fire on 2 gigahertz for handy-talky communication to their firemen. I'm very skeptical of that. On top of that, I think any relatively smart fire department would fight that, even if they thought the FCC is forcing them into that kind of a move. So I think very few fire departments are going to allow that to happen, even if it was being forced on them. Anybody got any further words on this? Give me your call letters right now. KQRIW on the TechNet.
KC2 is NHI comment.
KC2 is ZHI. I should know. Maybe you came here already. What's your first name, sir? And go right ahead with your comment.
Okay, name here is Jay. I'm in Woodmere. I'm also a volunteer fireman here in Woodmere and quite involved with communications throughout Nassau County. 90% of the fire departments here in Nassau County operate UHF, most in the 450 to 470 range. Some have gone up to the T-band to 470 to 490. A couple of departments gone up to the 500 range. But for the most part, most of the fire departments still have a 4610, 46 megahertz alert frequency. Some still have 46 megahertz operations frequency. But majority of the HTs at this point are UHF, a couple departments still on VHF in the 150s range. But for the most part, Nassau County, I don't think there's anyone that uses 800. The county does have an 800 system here in Nassau, but very seldomly used. It was really designed as a DPW system for mobiles. Some years ago, they tried issuing HTs to all the departments. Coverage issues basically prevented us from really using them. So at this point, we're all UHF.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of good information there, Jay, and I thank you for that. So for the Woodmere Fire Department, as well as many other Nassau and probably Suffolk Fire Department, I think you're saying the majority of the handy-talkie communication, I think very little of it's going to be 800 to handy-talkies for reasons I mentioned earlier. My guess is there are a few fire departments that haven't switched over to 470 yet. They might still be using 155 megacycle regen. And I know there's a general call frequency around 46 megacycles where some of the communication is used, but I don't think that's used from base station to individual firemen with their handy talkies. I think that's a general, what I'm going to call it now, sort of a party line between the various fire departments. I'm guessing 46 megacycles got used an awful lot when the fire departments wanted to talk to each other during the range fires that we had three, four, 5 years ago. I forget how many years ago it was when we had those out east range fires. So what is 46 megs used primarily for these years, Jay? And do you think that 46 megs is going to continue to be used? Is that sort of an inter-service communication channel? Back to you, Jay. KC2, ZHI, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, primarily 46.10 megahertz, 4610, is used as a Nassau County countywide alert frequency. And then there are several other frequencies, three others, which are used, shared by several battalions, each for local operations, so to speak, 4620, 4612, and 4632, each being used for three battalions each. As more and more departments have been switching over to entirely to UHF operations up in the 450s range, operations on 46 have become less and less. Some departments will simulcast both on UHF and VHF, but for the most part, a lot of departments have been switching up to UHF for reasons of range, high power, one frequency for all purposes, both alerting and operations, aside from I'll use the term technical, tactical operations on a fire ground. But for the most part, many departments have just abandoned low band altogether and gone up to UHF. It just it made more sense. As the major manufacturers have gotten away from making equipment in that 46 megahertz range, Motorola probably only makes one or two models in the low band range at this point, both for an HT and for a mobile. So for the most part, they've gone UHF and VHF, mostly UHF at this point.
K2MIT.
Jeff recognized, but I've got another set of questions for you, Jay. Jay, you're giving us some very valuable information, and I thank you. With your acquaintance with local fire departments, particularly in Nassau, and you probably are well communicating with people in Suffolk, make me a rough guess. I'm trying to find out what percentage of the fire departments are still making substantial use of 150 megacycles for communication with their firemen versus 470 or 450. In other words, what I'm looking for is a rough guess on your part. Are 20% of the fire departments still using 150, and the majority of them are switching over to 470? Is that or 450? Is that approximately where it might stand right now? Over to you, Jay, ZHI, KQRIW.
As far as I'm aware, in Nassau County, there are probably only 3 or 4 out of 71 fire departments that are still using anything in the VHF. Most have gone up to UHF, or like I said, are on low band, on 4610, 4620, that range. There is a volunteer ambulance corps countywide frequency, which is 154.115. That's used primarily by 4 volunteer ambulance corps, and again, some of them have started to migrate up. I work very closely with Atlantic Beach Rescue. They have begun to migrate up to UHF to 468 frequency. I think there are, like I said, there's only 3 or 4 that are left on the VHF cycle at this point.
Very good information. And now the last question I've got for you, Jay. Are any fire departments in Nassau or Suffolk, to your knowledge, using 800 megacycles or above, 700, 800 megacycles or above, for handy-talky communication with their firemen? Are there any fire departments you know of that are being moved above 450, 470 to any frequency higher? Or is that even just being proposed or being refused? Where do we stand on possible use of higher frequencies in the 450 range? Or do you have reason to believe that 450 is as high as they're going to go and they're going to stay there because it solves all their problems per se? Over to you, Jay, KQRIW.
KC2ZHI. As far as I'm aware, there are no fire departments in Nassau County that are using 800 megahertz for quote-unquote daily operations. Again, we do have access to the Nassau County public works system, which is 800. It's a GE EDAX system. But I, as far as, to the best of my knowledge, there are no departments that use it for a day-to-day system. It is available for our use. We have used it on occasion. We have used it in the events of major emergencies. As you were mentioning, we had the we had some wildfires last year up in the Syosset area, the Suffolk County border. It was used during that for interoperability purposes. It's also used, that county system, for the fire marshals, which is a county paid agency, not a volunteer thing. But for the most part, it is not used by the individual departments outside of special events.
Has anyone ever talked about future moves to 800 meg or higher frequencies for any purpose with day-to-day operations, handy-talkie operations firemen? Is anybody talking about a future at 800, or do you have reason to believe that they're quite happy with the 450 region and that's where they're going to stop and stay? You might have some opinions on that one. Back to you, Jay.
I think part of the problem at this point is Nassau County, the county itself, does not have the funds to assist the various departments to migrate anywhere else. All the departments are basically self-funded, either from taxes, donations, or contracts. But everybody's pretty much set up on UHF at this point. I think, as far as I'm aware of, every fire department in Nassau does have UHF capabilities to some extent. There are countywide fire ground frequencies that are available, licensed to Nassau County and given for use to any other department that wishes. I can't see a migration anywhere higher, at least not as the current state of the county. Years down the road, if the county were to go a paid department, would they migrate? There's always that chance. Now that Nassau County has begun to use a new 500 megahertz APCO P25 system for the police department. There was talk about eventually bringing the fire service up onto that, but that's in the 500 megahertz range, and I really can't see them going anywhere outside of that.
KC2MDP.
D recognized MDP, and you're right after Jeff. Okay. Lots of very good, valuable information you're giving us, Jay. Please check in more often and keep us informed as to what the fire departments are using. Their good two-way radio communication is vital to properly carrying on those services from both base station to vehicle and base station to individual firemen with handy talkies. Jay was the next person with a question on all of this, KC, or comment. K2MIT, go ahead, Jeff, K2LIW.
Yeah, let me just refine what I was saying. I wasn't saying everyone did it. What I was referring to was there's an FCC plan to move some people. I'm reading off of the FCC website. 800 megahertz public safety and Sprint Nextel. And Sprint Nextel thinks that they can own the world, and they have really bad coverage issues, as the firefighters found out in the World Trade Center and other places when they use those really high-frequency radios. In mid-2005, wireless communications managers commenced the process of moving selected public safety radio channels to new frequencies, part of a 3-year plan to migrate persistent problems with interference to their radio communications. The interference usually takes the form of dropped calls or dead space with radio communications. It just talks about moving about 24 hertz of bandwidth at 800 megahertz and 800 megahertz range from 809 to 815 and from 854 to 860 and some other things. Whether Nextel has sold those systems or not, I have no idea. I just know that there was this so-called migration, and then they were going to free up what was left of where they were and auction that out to commercial services. I know that's always a concern when that happens. So, and I won't be here next Sunday, but I will be here the Sunday after, because we're going on vacation next week. So I'll check in the Sunday after if you have it. That would be a great help at our article on the all. Thanks very much. K2MIT.
KC2ZH, I can answer that one.
KC2QIQ, a comment?
No beg.
Yeah, not to worry. To my knowledge, New Orleans had switched to 800 megacycles for their law enforcement frequencies. And that created a huge problem during Hurricane Katrina. That communication system failed miserably for a whole lot of reasons. But I think they had moved themselves up to 800 megacycles. All right, the next person on this list was Steve, KC2MDP, I think it is. Go ahead, Steve, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Yeah, just for your info, the city fire department is still using the 154 megahertz frequencies. They have a new allocation now with UHF in the 486 band, but they only use that for tactical and fire ground communications. But dispatch and everything is still on 154 as far as the city goes. And I don't know what they're using. They must have some transmitter, because to listen to calls from, let's say, Queens, I mean, it's broadcast quality. And I haven't listened to it in a while, but years ago I used to be able to listen to it like out in Farmingdale and everything with a scanner with a little rubber duck on it, and the quality of their transmission is just totally unbelievable. It's like you listen to FM stereo almost. Back to you.
Yeah, being New York City, for all we know, they're transmitting from the Empire State Building. I'm only joking a little bit, Steve. Good information. Okay, we got Jay and Glenn in that order with some further comments. KC2ZHI, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, KC2ZHI. As far as the 800 megahertz rebanding, as it was mentioned, it was a Sprint Nextel lawsuit, I guess you would say, a complaint with the FCC that required rebanding of many 800 megahertz systems, including Nassau County's. Approximately 3 years ago, Nassau County had a reband, and they came to us, reprogrammed all of our 800 HTs and mobiles, which they had given us. As part of that, certain radios, which were older, were not able to be rebanded and had to be replaced at the cost of $1 million to the county.
which supposedly was refunded to the county by Nextel. I can't answer any further than that. That's all I got about that one.
Now, let me understand that. This rebanding, were these handy talkies? Are fire or police or anybody, any of the emergency services, using a handy talkie at 800 megs? And has that really been tried and proven to be successful in range, reliability, and whatever? Give me a few more words on that one, Jay. Go ahead.
Okay, I can only answer as far as NASA County is concerned. As I said originally, the NASA County 800 megahertz system, again, it's a GE EDAX system, was designed in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, primarily for use by DPW. It was never designed for police department, fire department, EMS, or any other county agency. It was designed as a mobile-only 800 megahertz system for DPW use, dump trucks, sanders, road crews, etc., for mobile use only. There were two sites, one being Nassau County Medical Center in East Meadow, the second being North Shore Towers up on the North Shore, they then had a brainstorm of getting all the fire departments these radios, as well as many other county agencies for interoperability purposes. The sheriff's department now uses them. The district attorney uses them. I believe the parks department uses them as well. But the fire service, again, they gave us the radios. They gave each department two radios. It was your choice of whether it was a portable or a mobile. It was not designed for long-term usage, for fireground usage, so to speak, for main operations. It was really designed for interoperability between county agencies and other fire departments in the event of a major emergency, but not for a everyday occurrence.
Thank you very much for that information, Jay. Good stuff. Please check in more often. Glenn, KC2QIQ, KQRIW.
Yeah, actually, Dick, I think all my comments were pretty much covered. I think initially when I was making the comment when I first came in was because somebody had made the comment about everything was up on 800 and moving to the gigahertz. And I was like, I don't know where that information came from, but that was way off base. I've been listening to scanners in this area for years, and just about everything is in the UHF spectrum. I mean, there might be a little bit of stuff on VHF, but I mean, realistically, if you want to listen to either police or fire anywhere in Nassau or Suffolk, or for that matter, most of New York State, as far as I know, it's in the UHF spectrum, except for the city. The city's VHF, and there again, it's lack of funds. And just another little note on the UHF spectrum, that was one of the threats to amateur radio, was that because they were actually thinking of even expanding UHF even more, that we might have lost the, our 70-centimeter band. But luckily so far it looks like, the amateur hold on that band is at least sharing it anyway. It looks like it's going to hold for a while. At least that was the last note that I saw from Peter King. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Good information, Glenn. As you can tell, I'm very skeptical that we're going to get good coverage throughout a town, throughout the hills and valleys and with the trees and building blockages and everything else, to a handy talkie at 800 megacycles. To get proper coverage in a town that way, I think, is very difficult. So even if Motorola hands you those handy talkies, a sample number of them free of charge, until you do a full range reliability test, I don't think anybody should consider flipping over to that. I've heard too many horror stories of a few so-called progressive first responder organizations that have attempted that, and there's some bugs in that system as far as I'm concerned. I think, I'm not sure, that the some of the grief in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina could have been aggravated by that premature switchover. We should go over to the mailbag now. And Mel, what kind of burning questions have you had this week? K2, K-E-Y, K2-L-I-W on the TechNet.
Apology from K2-M-I-T.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I don't know. My brain did I don't know what went on. I made that terrible comment about going to 1.2 gigahertz. I don't know what I was thinking. I was completely wrong. I knew they were moving some, but it wasn't. It was within 800. Sorry, KTMIT.
Not to worry, Jeff. You're allowed a couple of errors. We're not that persnickety here. And that's one of the things I should have mentioned during my intro, and that is, of all the information you hear from me, Mel, or anybody else, there's no guarantee you're going to get 100% accuracy. However, to some degree, what you're hearing is peer-reviewable material by way of the website amateurradio.tangovictor and various people listening to that. 180,000 people have already checked into that website, downloaded that information, and listened to it. And when they find errors, they let us know real fast, and we let you know about those errors. There's no guarantee. Nobody's perfect. We all have a certain batting average, and nobody bats 1,000. So occasionally you're going to hear some errors, and hopefully they eventually get corrected. But we accept that. We go on, and a smart person will laugh at the errors he makes, and he tries to avoid them. But you try to live a life where you never make an error. You try to live a life where you have zero risk in your life, and you're not going to be living. You're not going to get out of this one alive, if you know what I mean. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead with your mailbag, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, you're right, Vic. This is K2KEY. Say everything is a chance in life. So just try to make every day a day that you, like to say, enjoy things and don't take things, try not to take things over serious. I'm sure found that out. what could possibly, how life, you know, turns inside out real quick. Just looking through some things here, you know, just in general. I mean, don't get too many anymore like I used to, I guess, because of, don't get many, you know, way many that we put on the air anyhow. Let me drop and then we'll pick up this one.
Coming. Check in at me.
Somebody say something or should I go ahead? Okay, what happened here? K2RIW, K2KEY, we're still in contact.
You caught me away from the rig while I was going to get my paperwork off the printer. And I'm listening with a handy talkie, but I'm away from the rig. Go right ahead, Mel.
Check in.
Okay, well, we got a check in. You want to pick up the check in or you want to go ahead with the mailbag?
Our person with the check in, give me your call letters and name at this time.
Yes, it's Tony, WFTW. Just checking in. I do have a question, but let Mel take it with his mailbag, WFTW.
It sounds like you said Whiskey Sierra 2 Whiskey. Is that your call letters, Tony? And we'll put you on the list.
No, it's Whiskey 2 Whiskey. Again?
Very fine. Whiskey 2 Whiskey. You said it so fast, Tony. Very good. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. This is KTKY again. All right, here's one. This is of interest to a lot of people. I see a lot of power supply sold at ham convention. Does it really make a difference if I buy a power supply that has a transformer, one of the old heavier units, or do you think that switching power supply is a better purchase? For a transceiver, I need approximately 20 amp power supply. I don't know. I guess if you're not going to carry it around, there isn't much to worry about, you know, whether it's switching or it's got a power transformer, I assume, take over.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it back to you, Mel, for opinions on this. I'm going to express some opinions. And there's no exact solution to this one. It's almost like, will I be happier if I marry a blonde, brunette, or a redhead? Lots more variables involved. The good news of a switching power supply is they tend to be a lot lighter, they don't have a great big power transformer, and they're physically smaller. And if you choose one of good design, the well-designed switching power supplies can be extremely quiet as far as acoustic noise is concerned and as far as radio noise is concerned. However, there have been a number of horror stories of a few brand names of switching power supplies that make a whole lot of radio noise. The switching power supply might give you, a spurious signal every 50 kilohertz up the band because it's running at a 50 kilohertz switching rate if it's not well filtered. So switching power supplies can be troublesome. If you want small size and portability, certainly give them a strong consideration. And I think switching power supplies tend to be a little bit more pricey. The old-fashioned power supplies with the transformer tend to be radio-wise quieter, a little more voluminous, a little bit heavier, and in some cases less expensive. And so the pros and cons there, as you can tell. If you had the choice of buying a unknown switching power supply as opposed to a somewhat old-fashioned, tried-and-true, dyed-in-the-wool transformer-type power supply, and it was at the right price at a flea market, I'll bet you might buy the transformer one, wouldn't you, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, no doubt. I have both here. And I have no preference, really. The old version, of course, the power transformer is a lot larger, a lot heavier. The new modern switching power supplies have gone. They have gotten away from that problem of HF, you know, RF hash and all that stuff because they've gone up in frequency, I know, considerably. I bet you Glenn will most likely make a comment on it because I think he's daily involved in power supplies. So I don't think there's any problem like that to really in the switching power supplies, modern version. The one I'm using right now, in fact, is a design from the magazine, the XQ2 FOD's version that was in the handbook by Manfred Morningwig, I believe it is. Over.
Q2RU info.
IU with info. We'll get to you in a minute. The XQ2 FOD switching power supply, which I think was in the December 1999 and January 2000 issue of QST Magazine lead article. Very well done switching power supply. I think it's a 40 ampere, if I remember, 12 volt 40 ampere switching power supply. And this man who lives in La Salina, Chile. I've had lots of QSOs with him email-wise. Real good ham radio operator. A real smart engineer who did at the time have quite a few years of history with the European Southern Observatory. He's the main electronic engineer that was maintaining power supplies and other equipment. Let me drop. At this major optical telescope installation in Chile, in the mountains of Chile. And boy, did he design a power supply. His motive for designing that power supply is he was maintaining a number of remote repeater sites in the mountains in Chile. And he's the guy who would have to climb the mountain and repair the power supply when it failed. So he did all kinds of heroic things with limited components that he could buy in Chile. When he goes down to, I can't think of the capital right now, but he doesn't have a local Radio Shack, if you know what I mean, where he can buy all kinds of parts. He has to get almost everything shipped to him from a foreign country. So he had some real difficulty getting good parts. He wound his own transformers, switching power supply transformers and so on. So he managed to find ways of making switching power supplies extremely quiet and extremely reliable. So when you see those articles, the first impression that everyone has is, why is there so many extra components there? I've seen power supplies that are a lot simpler than this. Yeah, but they don't have the performance of this thing. This thing was self-protecting from short circuits. You could take the output of that power supply and capacitively couple it to the input of your HF receiver, and you scan 3 to 30 megacycles, and you don't find any spurious output from that power supply. It was quiet. High efficiency, high performance, lots of reliability, but it's got a lot of extra components. It's not simple, and that's what a good design has to do, if you know what I mean. So there are switching power supplies and there are switching power supplies, as you can tell. Mr. W2IU, I think it was, something 2IU, give me your name, sir, your full call, and your comment on the subject of power supplies. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
I didn't hear a drop. Okay. Good evening, Dick, and the rest of the net. W2IU. Name is Dennis. We're over in New Jersey. Just a comment. While we are both, or should I say on both types of power supplies, the old transformer and the switching power supply,
Yes, you're expected to connect a ground to it. However, I found in my own experience that the switching power supply can easily be damaged if someone is sloppy about the ground, whereas you might not have as much of a problem as with a old transformer type. In fact, I think I managed to damage one because I didn't have the ground connected properly. So I kind of think they're a little bit more touchy, if that's one way of calling it, one word for it, a little bit more demanding that the ground be good on a switching power supply, even though both of them, in our theory, should be grounded in either case. I just thought it just seems like the switching power supply was considerably more touchy, more demanding about such things as a ground. W2IU.
K2MIT, comment?
Jeff recognized. But Dennis, let me go back to your question, your comment. I'm assuming now that your particular switching power supply had a floating output positive lead and negative lead, and there was an individual third wire, which is the case ground. And if you didn't properly treat that case ground, and maybe you also had some remote sensing terminals on the power supply, if the case grounding and the remote sense terminals all were not properly connected, I think you're saying some grief could happen. So when you say the word ground, I'm guessing you're not just talking about the negative lead of a positive 12-volt power supply. I think you're talking about case grounding and or remote sensing wiring. Give us a few more words on that, Dennis. What do you believe was the source of the grief? W2, India Uniform, K2RIW.
Dick, I'll definitely say it was case grounding. There were two separate terminals for a negative and positive as far as connecting it to the rig, and it was the case grounding itself which was handled sloppily.
Did the instruction manual, the owner's manual, give you a recommendation as to how you're supposed to treat the case grounding? Was it supposed to be kept separate from the remote sensing plus and minus leads? What do you believe was the nature of the error? Dennis, go ahead.
My own indication, the nature of the error was that it was just connected to what was thought to be a ground and turned out to maybe be not as conducting, I guess, would the term be. But it was definitely case grounding that was not done. You connected a wire to it, put it to what you thought was the ground lug, and it just apparently was done a little bit sloppily. You know, we want to rush to get the rig up and running, and it didn't take long for it to ruin the power supply. W2IU.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. Sounds like you got to be a little bit careful there. Jeff, K2MIT, go right ahead, K2RIW.
Yeah, besides being into ham radio, also an amateur astronomer, have my own German equatorial mount, which is a mount that can be synchronized with Polaris and then track at the sidereal rate, which is the rate that the stars are moving, so you can keep something in focus. 99% of all of the German equatorial mounts that I've seen in observatories across the United States, which swing anywhere from 50 to 200 pounds of telescope, and that's a lot of torque that you're moving, all use switching power supplies. And all of the manufacturers of these mounts all state you must use these types of supplies. Why? I've never actually quite figured out. I've always wanted to know. If you have the answer to that, I'd like to know, but it's just something I've noticed and observed. Thought I'd add that to the conversation. K2MIT.
KC2QIQ, the comment?
Yeah, Glenn recognized. I own a Celestron 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain, which also has the equivalent of a German mount. It really is, let me think. Yeah, it is a kind of a German mount. That is to say, you set the declination appropriate to the latitude that you're living at. You therefore have a rotational axis that goes right through the Earth's axis to the North Star. And in my case, I think it's a 9-volt battery that runs it at the sidereal rate so that the Earth rotation is taken out, and therefore, when it's set up correctly, the star sits still. Mine runs on a 9-volt battery, and it's got a reasonable life to that battery. why I would have to run that on a switching power supply. I can see one slight advantage. The switching power supply is capable of being thoroughly isolated. You really got a primary and secondary to that equivalent of a transformer that's usually inside of a switching power supply. So you really got a floating plus and minus output. Some of the power transformer types, non-switching types, are really using the transformer in an autoformer mode where there is a connection between primary and secondary. Because the amount of insulation inside of the telescope is limited and you're using it outdoors, there is a slim possibility where you could have the hot lead of the 110-volt line powering your power supply, connected to the electronics that's doing the azimuthal rotation, the sidereal rotation of the telescope. You could end up with a hot chassis on the telescope, and you're standing on wet ground or moist ground on the nighttime, and therefore there could be a shock potential. That's a pure guess on my part, which might be their fear. Let's see what Glenn's got to say about this one. KCQQIQ, you're a man with a telescope. Why do you think they insist on that, Glenn? K2LIW and the Tech Man?
More of a recommendation.
Well, Dick, I think as you're probably aware, at least most people in engineering background right now are pretty much aware of, is that the international rules for power and power requirements are getting more and more difficult to meet every year. Everything from, you know, power requirements, efficiency requirements, EMI requirements, isolation requirements, safety requirements, and everything that you can do with a switching power supply, I mean, theoretically, you could do it with a linear. The problem with the linear is that it becomes so large and so heavy and so expensive that it's no longer really a practical way to design. When you start talking about things, especially in a kilowatt above, you have to meet power factors that's like a light bulb, 0.999 and above. Then, of course, there's the efficiency issues, isolation issues, surge requirements, EMI filters, just the ability for the switching power supply to switch at higher frequency allows you to keep the magnetic components, like your transformers and inductors, at a much, much smaller size. But that's just part of the story, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Tommy? John recognized. Glenn, I know that you on a daily basis design switching power supplies for light-emitting diode use. And so people just love light-emitting diodes these days because they have extremely high efficiencies, extremely long life, and you can get almost any spectrum out of them that you want if you choose the right model numbers of the actual light-emitting diodes. And so where you're doing power factor correction, trying to make the switching power supply powering your light-emitting diodes act like it's a pure resistive load, like it's an incandescent resistive load. Do you think there is much difficulty for a ham radio operator buying a mediocre brand of switching power supply, possibly running into problems of either safety or electromagnetic interference? Is his 80-meter band going to have some spurious emissions in it caused by the switching power supply if he's not careful with the selection? What's your guess on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
Well, I guess just going back to experience from my years working in microwave power devices, where I designed, one of my requirements there was actually to design power supplies for a lot of power amplifiers. And I can honestly say that even in some of the sloppiest designs that I saw there before I started working there, that even the sloppiest designs had virtually no effect on any spurious emissions on the output of anything on HF or VHF, UHF, and microwave. So I think as far as that concern on the output is concerned, I would have to say I would have to doubt it. Let me close this drop for a second. I think the biggest problem with switching power supplies in terms of radiation problems are typically on receivers. Right now, the near field to a power supply and the wiring of ground could be an issue. And here again, most modern equipment, especially if you're going out and buying a new radio today and it comes matched with a power supply, most of those considerations have already been taken in those power supplies, and they're generally pretty good. I think where you could a ham radio operator could run into a problem is if they're trying to match a brand X power supply with brand Y transceiver, where you might want to listen to some people who have already used that power supply with that type of equipment to see if it's a good match. Here again, and what's the downside? More than likely, the real problem is you'll start getting some noise on certain bands as you go through it that normally wouldn't be there with a linear deck. But then again, there's no guarantee. I've seen linears that have some oscillation problems on the output when it operated in certain modes that create noise problems also. So there again, I think it's just properly matching your power supply with your transceiver. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
K2MIT comment.
Jeff recognized after John. The assume I was making a switching power supply where the actual switching rate was, I'm going to pick a number, 150 kilohertz. That's the actual inverter rate on the switching power supply. That's going into a toroidal transformer. The output of 150 kc, a quasi-square wave, is being rectified, and that goes into a regulation network of some kind, which could be, in some cases, a synchronous rectifier, and it could be even much more complicated circuits than that. In theory, with that 150 kHz switching rate of my particular example, because a receiver, a really good HF receiver, can receive small fractions of a microvolt, I might find spurious resignals every 150 kHz up the band, and that's going to strike quite a few ham bands. I may meet the requirements for the usual specification for a power supply of ripple in millivolts and spikes in volts and whatever. But because a receiver is so extremely sensitive and it's only 1 foot away from the power supply in some cases, I think I've got to worry a little bit about that. Is that sort of what you're referring to, Glenn? And if that did occur, if the switching rate was 150 kc and it's making a spurious signal every 150 kc up the band, do you believe that's an easy thing to solve? Or is that something that I have to, again, worry about? Brand X of power supply with brand Y of transceiver may not be a compatible combination. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I would have to suggest getting the right power supply for the right transceiver. I think if you have a power supply, if anybody runs into a problem where you have a power supply and you're getting noise on a receiver, and to think that the average amateur radio operator could probably sit down with some capacitors and inductors and clean it up, I think that it would be really an act of frustration and your chance of winding up with success. Dick, I've been designing switching power supplies for over 25 years, and whenever there's a receiver slash power supply problem, I sweat a little bit about it, trying to clear it up and get rid of it. Generally, with something like that, you want to design the power supply from the beginning with the transceiver in mind to work around those kinds of issues. But sometimes, you know, trying to put a filter on the outside, especially to get rid of common mode noise interference, I mean, you could eventually probably get a filter on there, but it might be bigger than the power supply when you're done. I would just, at that point, I think I'd rather find a different power supply. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I'm hearing that we got to be a little bit careful. We got John and Jeff in that order. John, KC2WGB, I wonder what your experience is with switching power supplies. And if you ran into a problem, how did you solve it? You've got it, John.
Yes, Dick, I've had a few problems. I went through about 5 switch mode power supplies in my time. I haven't owned one in about 5 years, but I have 3 70 amp, the Astron type, brute force or linear supplies. I've never had a problem with them. But yet, I know they've gone, there's been great advances in these switch mode power supplies, but they just didn't seem reliable enough. And they worked well when they worked, but it seems that it was either line transient or maybe load transient that affected them drastically. Where with the linear supplies, I've never had the problem. So I just signed off. I just won't buy them anymore. I just don't have enough experience to maybe correlate the two. But I found linear to be far superior.
Yeah, but John I know is a bit of a scientist, and if he did get a failure of a switch mode power supply because of a line transient, I'll bet you went and troubleshot it and found out what it is. Was it the input bridge rectifier that got damaged? What was the nature of the failure if you happened to have troubleshot the switch mode power supplies when you did have them in your shack, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, I looked into all of them. Three of them were the switching transistors themselves that failed, and two were diode problems. And it seems to be the consistent failure in most of those. They were only about 2 years in operation when they failed. They seemed to have a two-year life. But and they were heavy units. Those were only, I think, 40 or 50 amp supplies. But the 70 amp supplies, I haven't had anything go wrong with them yet, knock on wood. But I did look into them, and I just said, you know, it's not worth it. Just throw them out and buy the right thing.
Okay, there's the voice of experience, the man who's been there. Let's see what your experience is like, Jeff. K2MIT, K2RIW.
I had one comment to something. I had, let's see, a linear supply that I was using in my shack that was fit in a rack, so it's 19 inches across. I don't know, 10 amps. I replaced a box one-third of its size, still 10 amps, and it was a third of the price. And the new one's made in America, too, where the other one was made someplace else. Dick, I believe your telescope's probably mounted on an alt azimuth type of mount with an equatorial wedge that I had to get when I'm seeing it, but trying to come up with a term like the best type of mount most likely have. And back to you.
That's exactly right, Jeff. It is a wedge. That is the typical Celestron way of doing it. This is a Celestron 1988 product, I guess it was, when it was originally purchased. I'm the second owner. Quite pleased with it. And it really isn't a equatorial mount. It is the wedge type, and you're right. It looks like it's got a tripod with a flat platform with a wedge. And then on the wedge is the one axis of rotation that's done by the internal motor and the timing circuit that takes out the rotation. And let me think now. As far as the way the bearings are set, let's see, I've got the elevation over azimuth, you're right, and the azimuth is on the wedge. And when it comes to where the bearings and where the real right ascension and declination settings of the telescope are concerned, physically, the German mount looks very different. But isn't the operation somewhat the same? There still is a main bearing, which is the one that takes out Earth rotation, and the declination bearing is above that one and works from it. So it looks physically different, but isn't there a strong similarity in their real process of operation? What's your feeling on that one, Jeff? K2MIT, K2LIW.
They are similar. Actually, the declination axis of the German GEM mount, the German equatorial mount, barely moves. It's mostly the RA that moves. I think the deck axis, once in 24 hours, it moves that slow. So really, GEM, you have to align it with Polaris, so that's your latitude, so the up position is your latitude, which is the same as the same degree that your wedge is set to. So that wedge is the same as the angle that the GEM is pointed up at, which we use a polar scope to look through, that angle being whatever latitude you're at, north of the equator. The RA is both... then now have RA equals RA for both mounts. You couldn't do it without the wedge. If you just had the alt azimuth mount, you could move to places and look at things, but you would not be able to cut out the stars, and any photographs you took would have star trails in them, if that makes sense to you. The wedge is what counteracts or gets you to become like a GEM.
Yeah, we're all getting a little bit smarter on this one. You said the declination moves once per 24 hours. I think you meant the right ascension moves once per 24 hours. The declination is something that typically you set once if you're tracking a particular star. And Meade really uses a elevation over azimuth mount, the Meade mount, that fork of the Meade, and there you have to steer as an L simultaneously in order to track a star. And the disadvantage of the Meade is now, if you're doing a time-lapse photography, in the eyepiece, the sky does a rotation around the target star. You have to have a third motor to take out the other rotation because it's not equatorial light. These are fun subjects. We're getting far off subject. We're going to go back to Mel, and we've gotten a lot of opinions on power supplies. And if you want to go to one more email subject, go right ahead, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, 10 o'clock, but all right, I'll give a shot at one more here. I was just looking at, where was I, just looking at it. It's kind of interesting, you know, like I say, Hua Ham usually have basic questions. And, okay, here's one. Let me let it drop and I'll read it. I've gotten interested in slow scan television, and I finally picked up the software allows me to receive SSTV using my computer sound card. I am very confused. How many are there? I am very confused as to by all the modes in use. How many are there, and how do you know which one is being sent? That's true. There's a lot of modes. Remember, after TV, when I first started, I was one of the first, I guess, the first 10 when I met the original designer of SSTV, and we didn't have very many modes. We just had, basically the P7 Foxfer, we see our homemade monitors, but sure has changed a lot, Dick. Over.
Yeah, in those days, you were painting the picture onto a long, persistent phosphor, a fancy screen that had the picture would stay there for a large number of seconds, and you would slowly paint that picture. And because of the limitations of the hardware, everyone had settled on a particular scan rate, a particular number of lines, and so on. Now that we have digital storage and digital playback. In other words, you could be painting the picture onto your display device, onto your monitor, at one rate, and you're loading the picture into the display device at an entirely different rate. That now gives you a fantastic amount of freedom. So you can choose the rate at which you send the data and the way that you modulate the data. So there's lots and lots of different modes that are now suddenly available to you with digital display techniques. Let me drop. So now you get the trade-off of how much resolution do you want the picture to have, how much signal-to-noise ratio do you think the channel has that you're sending the signal, that the picture through, how long are you willing to wait for the picture to fill up. There's a whole lot of variables. As such, I am guessing we've got a lot of different modes of operation. And I think the answer is that there's got to be an agreement between you and the guy that's sending the picture ahead of time. I'm using the so-and-so mode. Please set up your receiver for that mode. There is an alternate, and that is because it is a digital technique and you can take the raw data that you're receiving and record it onto your hard disk drive or other medium that you want to, and then you can take your own sweet time and play it back with mode 1, mode 2, mode 3, and find the mode that gives you the picture you're looking for. That's one possible operation, is a guess on my part. Let's see if we've got some slow scan TV people with experience on frequency that can give us a better answer than mine. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. There's a video man from way back. There's the chief engineer from Channel 13 and Channel 21, broadcast public television in the New York area. So tell us about slow scan television, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIWK2J. Most software today actually will auto detect the sync rate of the particular format that's being sent. There are so many of them, different SCSI rates, different a whole bunch of them. The only thing that Some of the earlier software won't do because there are some different modulation schemes. They don't figure it out, but a lot of the current freeware that's out there, you just